I see people up on the roof over here, digging a hole in the roof. I presume they are about to let a man down through the roof, and I wonder if Jesus has been sighted yet. I suppose if Jesus showed up in Louisville, he would be sighted. That is, the police would give him a ticket one way or another. I argued yesterday that in certain respects, important respects, postmodernism is not the threat to biblical faith that it is widely perceived to be, both by friend and foe alike. That two of its central themes, at least, Heidegger's critique of ontotheology and Lyotard's critique of meta-narratives, are not directed at biblical faith, but at secular substitutes for them, that there are biblical and theological motivations for sharing something very like that critique of those secular projects, and that Christian thought might very well incorporate into itself themes that would look very similar to those two. They would be different insofar as they'd be recontextualized. They'd be in a theistic and Trinitarian Christological context rather than in an atheistic context, but they would still have recognizable similarity with those themes as they appear in the secular postmodern context. But having tried to argue against my postmodern friends that their theories don't do the damage to biblical faith that they would like to think they do, and having argued to my Christian friends that they're not such a terrible threat as my Christian friends think they are, there's another huge issue lurking in the background that may make all of my argument yesterday seem irrelevant. Postmodernism is widely seen as antithetical to Christianity because of a relativism that undermines theology by abandoning the difference between true and false, and undermines morality by abandoning the difference between right and wrong. In spite of the fact that they often describe their political commitments in terms of justice and do not treat this as a merely subjective preference, postmodernists are often awarded the honor usually reserved for freshmen and sophomores in their first undergraduate philosophy course of holding the view that any view is as good as any other, that anything goes, different strokes for different folks, and that everything is just a matter of personal taste. I like pistachio ice cream. My wife likes coffee ice cream. I like coffee. I don't like coffee ice cream. That view, it seems to me, makes them into the safest of all threats, the threat to public decency that can be denounced without any possibility of being put in question by the critique that they have to offer. As I warm to my subject, I'm going to take off my jacket. It is warm in here. Now, perspectivism is the name that I want to use for talking about the relativism that is attributed to postmodernism. And we'll have to work our way to that slowly. In a couple of stages, we'll take a couple of brief tours through the history of philosophy. No extra tuition is charged for these tours, but there will be a quiz. I'd like to start with my frog is back. I'd like to start with what I do whenever I'm trying to get students into Kant's critique of pure reason, and get them to take seriously what they have a very hard time taking seriously because it's so counterintuitive. So I tell them this story. I'm about to turn on the evening news, and I know that Dan Rather's tie is going to be a gray tie, varying shades of gray depending on what the design is, but nevertheless, a gray tie. How do I know this? Well, they think for a little while and they say, well, you know, he's been wearing gray ties all week, so you figure probably he's going to wear a gray tie again tonight. And I say, no. maybe he's worn gray ties for four nights in a row, But this is Casual Fridays at CBS, and that's when he gets out his purple and yellow polka dot tie to wear for the evening news. And if I were making that sort of an inductive inference, I would say, well, you know, he wore gray ties 4 days this week, so probably he's going to wear a gray tie tonight. But I'm talking about a situation where, as I'm turning on the TV, there's no probably about it. I'm utterly certain that his tie is going to be gray. And As a matter of fact, I haven't been watching the news this week. As a matter of fact, I haven't been watching the news this month, so I don't know what his habits in ties might be. But I know that tonight it's going to be gray. Shades of gray, different shades of gray. This gets harder and harder each year. But suddenly a light will go on and somebody will say, ah, you're watching a black and white TV set. The problem is, of course, that every year fewer and fewer students not only have seen a black and white TV set, but even heard of one. But there still are a few who have at least heard of one, and they say, ah, that's it. And I say, bingo, now you understand Kant. The most important, the most fundamental idea in the Critique of Pure Reason is the idea that the human mind is like a receiving set, and it allows the world to appear to us, but it constrains it to appear in certain ways. And the ways in which it constrains it to appear to us do not correspond precisely to the way it really is. Dan Rather's ties are bright yellow and red and green and all kinds of wonderful colors. None of that ever comes through. The receiving apparatus compels that. If it's going to appear to me at all, it's going to have to appear to me gray. And Kant's view is that the human mind is that sort of a data processor. The information that comes to us from the world that's out there is made available to me. I have access to it, but only at a certain cost, only at a certain distortion, only at a certain revision, so that the world appears as it can appear to somebody who is accessing it through that sort of a receiving apparatus. And that he calls the world of appearances, as distinct from the world of things in themselves. The world of things in themselves is the way they really are, and the world of appearances is the way they appear to us when they've been processed by our black and white TV set. He also uses the language the phenomenal world and the noumenal world to make essentially the same distinction. One of the things that's important to notice is that there aren't really two worlds. There's only one world. But we can talk as if there were two worlds because we talk about the world as it would appear to somebody in the studio and the world, that same world, as it appears to somebody watching it on the black and white TV set. I'm looking at Dan Rather's tie, the only tie Dan Rather's wearing that night. That's the tie I'm in touch with. But I'm in touch with it in a mediated way. And I'm not the ideal observer of that tie. The ideal observer of that tie doesn't apprehend it through a black and white television apparatus. The ideal observer is in the studio, is operating with a perfectly good vision, and sees the tie directly and unmediated in all of its glorious color. Now for Kant, there's only one ideal observer in the studio, and that's God. And all the rest of us have our access to the world through the black and white TV set that is the human mind. And when Kant talks about the way things really are, things in themselves, he's very explicit about the fact that he's talking about the world, the only world there is, as it appears to an infinite creator, creative divine mind, the world as it appears to God. And when he talks about that other world, that world of appearances, that phenomenal world, he is talking about that very same world as it appears to those of us who are seeing it on black and white TV. Those of us who, by virtue of the fact that we don't see the whole picture, and we have finite minds, and we're dependent on our senses, and in a whole variety of ways, our knowing is different from divine knowing. Ours is finite, it is infinite. Ours is relative, it is absolute. And the discrepancy between the divine knowledge of the world and the human knowledge of the world is the discrepancy between things in themselves and appearances. Now, the irony is that that's a theistic theory. The distinction between God and human beings that's so fundamental to biblical faith is absolutely fundamental to Kant's anti-realism. That's a term that philosophers use to talk about that view. And I find it ironical that so many of my those philosophers I was talking about the other day, among the best of my philosophical friends who share my faith and are Christians, hold the view that if we're going to be Christians, we must be realists and not anti-realists. That is, we must disagree with Kant on that analysis of things. And of course, the disagreement doesn't consist in the metaphysical claim that the world is out there, independent of us. Kant holds that view. He thinks that the real is there, and it is what it is, independent of our apprehension of it. That's what he calls the thing in itself. That's what he calls the world of noumena. What he denies is the claim that's essential to the realist. Not only is the world out there independent of us, not only is what it is it what it is independent of our apprehensions, but in our apprehensions, we can grasp it as it is, independent of those apprehensions. We can know things as they truly are, as they are in themselves. Our knowing of things is the perfect mirror of things, the exact duplicate of things, the perfect correspondence. And in that sense, our knowledge is adequate to the things. The Latin term adequatio, which goes into a classical definition of truth, has the word equal in it. The one side of the equation is equal to the other. The thing and the representation of the thing are equal to each other. The one is the perfect mirror of the other. That is the realist claim. Now, I find it ironical that so many of my Christian philosophical friends think that Christians ought to be realists. I think, in the first place, that Christians ought to be theists, and in the second place, that theists ought to be anti-realists. That theists ought to say that the distinction between divine knowledge and human knowledge is fundamental and qualitative and not merely quantitative. It's not just that God knows lots of things that we don't know, and we know a few things, and God knows a lot of things, and the pile of things we know is a small pile, and the pile of things God knows is a big pile. It seems to me that the difference between our mode of apprehending the world and God's is such that the things we know in a way that's qualitatively different. We're looking through a black and white TV set at what's going on in a studio in living color. And there's a deficiency. We don't get it. That there's an inadequacy about our knowledge of the world. That's a function of our createdness, our finitude. It is our createdness, of course, that puts us in touch with the world at all. God has given us a receiving apparatus that enables us to be in touch, to watch the evening news. And that's a wonderful gift. Without that gift, we'd be without Dan Rather and all the sad tales he tells every night. So one doesn't want to look a gift horse in the mouth and say, because you haven't made my knowledge on a par with your knowledge, God, I'm going to despise it and say it's no good. I'm simply going to acknowledge that when the Bible says our ways are not God's ways, that has to do with the whole scope of our knowing. Now, let me give you a second example that will be helpful to us. Before I do that, let me just call your attention to the fact that we're already on our way to perspectivism. On Kant's analysis, we have two perspectives on the world, the human perspective and the divine perspective. And if you inhabit one of them, you see them as you see them from that location. And if you inhabit the other, you see them as you would see them from that location. But they're two different ways of looking at the world, and the world looks different from the one perspective from the way it looks from the other perspective. Now, a second example. I encounter someone of a racial or ethnic group, or perhaps a gender group different from my own, and I know, with the same kind of certainty that I knew that Dan Rather's tie was going to be gray, I know that this individual, whom I have never met before, is morally and intellectually inferior to me. How do I know this? I built in the I've never met before thing, so I'm obviously not inferring from my past experiences and so forth. I know this in Kantian language a priori. Before I have any experience with this person, I know that this person is morally and intellectually inferior to me. How do I know that? Well, the answer is quite simple. I see the world through racist eyes. I have been socialized into a racist culture. I have learned a racist language game. And that is a perspective on the world. That racist life world into which I have been socialized is the receiving apparatus through which the world appears to me. The world, the only world that's out there, appears to me. I'm in touch with it, but it's distorted. The only way it can appear to me is through this network of receiving apparatuses that are my racist worldview. And so that individual cannot appear to me as he or she really is, but only as this particular receiving apparatus makes it possible to perceive that individual. And this particular receiving apparatus compels me to see that individual as morally and intellectually inferior to me. Now, the interesting thing about this example, once again, we got two perspectives, the non-racist perspective and the racist perspective. And in this case, we can think of them as two human perspectives. Kant analysis was always on the assumption that there was the human perspective. He thought that the world of Newtonian physics was the human way of looking at the world. And this example suggests that there may be, that the human mind may not be just one single receiving apparatus, but a series of rather different receiving apparatuses. And a second thing that's interesting to me about this example, the first example has to do with limitations on the receiving apparatus that don't have any moral dimension to them. There's a finitude about the black and white TV set relative to being in the studio. But there's a moral fault about the way in which my racist life world has been created, not wholly by me, to be sure, but by generations of people, and the sins of the fathers are being visited unto the children under the 30th and 40th generation. And I am responsible for allowing myself to be socialized into that. So fault as well as finitude, the fall as well as creation, can be a basis for there being a plurality of human perspectives. Now, Hegel comes along after Kant, and he has a much more historical sense of human life and experience than Kant does. That's one of the big dividing lines between the 18th century in general and the 19th century in general. And so Hegel is much more aware than Kant of the plurality of human perspectives. And he is, like anybody who starts along this line of thinking, getting nervous about the notion that truth is going to fall by the wayside if we get to, well, this is true from this perspective, but not from this perspective. If you're a racist, then it will be true that these people are inferior to me. But if I'm not a racist, it will not be true. Some of them will be morally and intellectually inferior to me, and some of them will be morally and intellectually superior to me, and I'm going to have to go by experience to find out what those are. And if I take Jesus seriously about the log and the beam and so forth, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time looking around for those who are morally inferior to me. That's not my job. But Hegel is aware of the fact that human experience comes in many different varieties, that we inhabit many different worlds, and that depending on what world we're inhabiting at any given time, the world is going to look different to us. Is it not the case that the world that is this seminary looks different from the standpoint of a student compared to the standpoint of a faculty member? Don't faculty and students live in significantly different worlds? Not absolutely isolated from each other. There's a certain overlap, there's a certain sharedness. But isn't there a lot of difference between giving a test and taking a test? Doesn't the world look very different on a test day depending on whether you're looking this way in the room or looking this way in the room? Well, Hegel's solution to the problem of knowledge and truth evokes that old story about the six blind men from Hindustan who had a debate about the elephant. You know the story. One of them had a hold of the tail, and he said the elephant is like a rope. They're blind, remember. And one of them had a hold of a leg, and he said, no, an elephant is like a tree. And one of them was up against the side, and he said, no, an elephant's like a house. And one of them had a hold of the ear, and he said, no, an elephant is like a palm leaf. And they had a really nasty fight about what an elephant was like, because each of them was apprehending the elephant from a limited, finite perspective. And none of them was able to put the pieces together to make a coherent picture of what an elephant is. What you and I can do is look at the tail and the legs and the side. We know how to put them together. But each of them was like they had a jigsaw puzzle and they had one piece and they were debating what the jigsaw puzzle is a picture of on the basis of that one piece. And Hegel argues the truth is the whole. It's only when we put all the pieces together that we can know what the jigsaw puzzle is a picture of. Only when we get all of the perspectives integrated into one coherent totality can we know what an elephant is like. And that was his way of acknowledging the plurality of perspectives that go into human knowledge and hanging on to the notion that we nevertheless have a single definitive truth with a capital T. You see, for Kant, human truth is truth with a small t. The only truth with a capital T is God's truth. And since our truth is systematically different from that, even when we get it right, that is, even when we think as human beings ought to think, our truth isn't the truth. And Hegel doesn't want to give up on the claim that we can have the truth, and so he tells this story about how we have to put all the pieces together in order to get the whole. Well, no sooner did Hegel finish with that than the rest of the 19th century let out a scream that is still echoing in postmodern philosophy. Human knowledge, by virtue of its finitude, cannot constitute the whole. The totality is an infinite totality that goes beyond our capacity. We are always in the situation of trying to figure out what the puzzle is on the basis of some of the pieces, but not all of the pieces. And we're having a conversation among ourselves like the six blind men from Hindustan. We're trying to compare our experience of the elephant, but we're trying to figure out how to make them fit together into a coherent picture. But think of the different possibilities you have as long as you're blind. The way in which you could put those pieces together and what you could come up with. None of us, important subsequent post-Hegelian thinkers said, are able to back off, open our eyes wide, look at the elephant, and see the totality, and know how the whole picture goes together. Kierkegaard contributed to that. He would often distinguish between Christianly understood and humanly understood. to different perspectives. One is an attempt to make sense out of the world without God in the equation, and the other is the attempt to make sense out of the world with God in the equation. And the world looks very different if God is one of the factors in your picture of the world from what it looks like if God is not one of the factors involved in your picture of the world. The difference between a created world and an uncreated world, a world of blind chance, and a gift of a loving creator, those are two very, very different worlds. And depending on which of those I'm inhabiting, the world is going to look very, very different to me. Interesting footnote. Kierkegaard lived in a time when, under the ongoing impact of the Enlightenment, secular thought liked to call itself reason as opposed to mere faith, and faith is sort of slips over into superstition and all kinds of nasty things. And so he has one of his pseudonyms engaging in a conversation about these two perspectives on the world, the humanly understood and the Christianly understood. And the humanly understood says, "We are reason, capital R." And Kierkegaard's pseudonym says, "Okay, you call yourself reason. I'll call myself, what shall I call? I'll call myself the paradox. I'll call myself something that doesn't make any sense to reason." Okay, now we've given ourselves names. Shall we discuss the differences among us? Or did you think they had been settled by the self-congratulatory gesture with which you called your point of view by an honorific title, reason? Isn't that precisely what's at question? Whether your view of the world is the reasonable view of the world? And in a very subtle and deft gesture, he sort of deflates a certain strategy in intellectual debate of baptizing oneself with honorific titles and slinging around negative titles to those one disagrees with and thinking that that constitutes an argument. He says, well, of course the paradox doesn't make any sense to reason once we've agreed who will have these names. But that paradox has been saying that for centuries. Haven't you ever read the Apostle Paul about foolishness to the Greeks and all that stuff? It's an acoustic illusion, Johannes Climacus says, to think that reason has discovered that it's at odds with the paradox. The paradox has insisted on this vigorously from the outset. It's exactly as you say. But is that an argument? It's a rhetorical question to which the answer is obvious. Nietzsche comes along and calls their attention to the multiplicity of perspectives through which we can see the world. We can see the world through the morality of the master. We can see the world through the morality of the slave. Nietzsche even throws in the mosquito. I prefer the bat. And try to think of how different the world appears to a bat or a mosquito from the way it appears to you. It's the same world that's appearing to the bat and to the mosquito, but my goodness, how radically different it is. And Nietzsche says, look, I know that there's a philosophical tradition that thinks that the way to be objective and to get to the truth is to flee from perspectives. Ever since Plato and the divided line, ever since Descartes and methodological doubt, philosophers have been trying to get to truth with a capital T by eliminating everything that's dependent on some particular contingent point of view, some perspective. And Nietzsche, like Kierkegaard, is one of those people who thinks that we can't jump out of our skin in that way. The only apparatuses we have for seeing the world are the finite and fallen apparatuses, which are the world in which we live. Of course, we can change from the world in which we find ourselves to some other world, But that other world is also a human world. It's not the divine world. It's a partial perspective. It's finite, it's fallen, it's contingent. We don't become God by moving from one human perspective to another human perspective. Nietzsche says, if you want to be objective, don't flee perspectives, but multiply them. Listen, if you're that guy with a hold on the elephant's rope, you should be talking to the guy with his arms around the elephant's leg, trying to find out what his experience of the elephant is, and seeing how you have to modify yours to take into account of how the world appears now, of course, it doesn't follow that everybody's experience is going to be equally weighty. If I want to know what color Dan's brother's tie is, I'm going to discard the experience of people I know to be colorblind. And if I want to know about the character of a particular person who's a member of some minority racial and ethnic group, I'm not going to consult with a person I know to be racist. But once I've done that sort of thing, there's still going to be, Nietzsche thinks, Kierkegaard thinks, a plurality of human points of view, all of which will fall short of being what Hegel thought we had to have, that vision of the whole, the all-encompassing vision of the whole, where all the pieces are fit together to form a coherent picture, and that is the truth that we were looking for. Now, Nietzsche's perspectivism is sort of the jumping-off point for postmodern perspectivism. I want to. There's another part of the story I hesitate to start with because I'm afraid it might take us longer than it should. So let's just work with that little version of the history of philosophy, the movement from Kant to Nietzsche. Kant's distinction between the human perspective and the divine. Hegel's recognition that human perspectives come plural, and that in order to have the truth, we'd have to be able to totalize them, we'd have to be able to integrate them into an all-encompassing synthesis in which nothing is left out, but everything has its rightful place. The subsequent claim of Kierkegaard and Nietzsche from, as you're well aware, very different theological interests and perspectives, that Hegel was right about the plurality of human perspectives, but that Kant was right that no human perspective can ever become the divine perspective. We can't ever complete that process of getting all the pieces of the puzzle together and seeing things in the wholly integrated way, which would be the divine knowledge of things. So it is true that postmodern philosophers can generally be described, along with many other contemporary philosophers, as perspectivists. There's nothing uniquely postmodern about this theory, about this way of thinking about human knowledge and truth. There's a common thread running through, and now I'm going to name some postmodern philosophers who are perspectivists. Nietzsche's perspectivism, that's his language. Heidegger's hermeneutical circle, Derrida's deconstruction, Foucault's genealogical analysis of knowledge as power, and Rorty's notion that our vocabularies are not dictated by reality but are optional. As usual, the details are quite technical in each case, the way in which each of these thinkers develops those themes, and I'm not going to go into those details. But the basic point is simply that we are not God. One of the ironies is that the atheistic postmodern philosophers continuously insist, as Kant did, on the theological character of this question. It's a question, who occupies the divine perspective? The view from nowhere, the view from everywhere, the view that is not one of those limited views in which you can only see what you can see if you're holding the tail, but don't have any access to the trunk and the leaves and so forth. And so I'm not the only one, given my theological interest, who says this is, in the final analysis, a question about whether human knowledge can ever occupy an essentially divine standpoint and no longer be knowledge from this particular human perspective. Their point is simply that we are not God. We do not occupy an absolute, all-encompassing point of view, but see whatever we see, including right and wrong, from a particular standpoint, constituted to a significant degree by contingencies of linguistic usage and socio-historical location. Constituted to a significant degree by contingencies of linguistic usage and socio-historical location. Think about our racist friend for a moment. Think about the way in which he came to see the world the way he sees it by being socialized into a particular human community. Think of the structure of that. And now take away the moral, the fundamental moral problem with that, and ask yourself, isn't it pretty much the same to be socialized into a Southern Baptist world? And isn't a Southern Baptist world not just different from Nietzsche's world, to be sure, but isn't a Southern Baptist world very different from an Episcopalian world or a Roman Catholic world? Aren't those different accounts of the elephant from different perspectives? And don't we come to see the elephant from one of those perspectives in the way in which, to a very large degree, in the way in which the racist came to be a racist by being socialized into a community? This is not to deny that the Holy Spirit may be involved in that process. But unless one wants to claim that the Holy Spirit's only involved when people are socialized into Southern Baptist communities and not in Episcopal or Catholic communities, unless one wants to claim a monopoly on the work of the Holy Spirit, just the plurality of Christian perspectives is going to suggest that our view of the elephant is not the view of the elephant. That we have some of the pieces of the puzzle, and from where we stand, we can see things that people can't see when they stand some other places, but conversely, they can see things that we can't see because they're looking from a different angle. And we can multiply perspectives. We can listen to our Episcopalian and Catholic friends, and we can listen to Nietzsche, and we can try to learn from them. We can try to broaden our picture and so forth. But short of claiming to be able to climb up Mount Babel and be like the Most High, that process of totalizing and getting a complete integration is going to be a task that always exceeds our powers. And just to the degree that it always exceeds our powers, we're going to be looking at the world through a black and white TV set instead of being there in the studio looking at Dan Rather's tie directly. Or we're going to be looking at the elephant from some but not all of the possible perspectives at which the elephant can be looked at. So back to the sentence that launched me on that little tirade. The point is simply that we're not God, that we cannot, that we do not occupy an absolute, all-encompassing point of view, but see whatever we see, including right and wrong, from a particular standpoint constituted to a significant degree by contingencies of linguistic usage and socio-historical location. These points of view, by analogy with vision, enable us to see what can be seen from that sight, but only by hiding from us what cannot be seen from there. If you're looking at this side of the moon, you can't see the other side of the moon. Now, is perspectivism just another name for relativism? That's the anxiety that this analysis inevitably and quite legitimately raises. And my answer is, I'm going to weasel here, yes and no. I'm a philosopher, what do you expect? If by relativism we mean the view that anything goes, that all views are equally valid, well then no. Perspectivism does not entail that conclusion, nor does any postmodernist that I know draw that conclusion. Nietzsche, for example, does not think that Christianity is just as good a religion as the Dionysian piety set forth by Zarathustra. And even Rorty is unwilling to tolerate cruelty as an alternative lifestyle. He's pretty free with alternative lifestyles, but not cruelty. But perspectivism is relativism in this sense. It is the dual claim that our insights, whether factual or normative, are relative to the standpoint from which they are made, and that the standpoint we occupy inevitably betrays that it is not the absolute standpoint, an all-inclusive, totalizing, divine standpoint that sees everything and is blind to nothing. The double claim, all of our insights are relative to the perspective from which we have them, and the claim that that perspective is always some human perspective and never the divine perspective. So the Kantian distinction between truth with a capital T as accessible to God only, and truth with smaller t as the best truth we could ever hope to have, reoccurs here in the context of a pluralized perspectivism. Now, to be sure, perspectivism is the relativism that insists that we are not God and that only God is absolute. To be sure, postmodernists sometimes overstate the case. They talk as if they had shown that there is no absolute truth because there is no one to occupy the absolute point of view. This is because they assume as a premise the Nietzschean notion that if we are not God, nobody else could be. But the analysis that show how our judgments are perspectival and relative provide no evidence for this claim that nobody else could occupy. That's just an assumption that Nietzsche and many of his postmodern colleagues add to their analysis of the perspectival character. And if you add together the notion of perspectival human perception and the notion that there is no divine perception, then you could draw the conclusion there is no truth with a capital T. My postmodern friend Jack Caputo formulates it this way: the truth is that there is no truth. The truth, small t, is that there is no truth, capital T, an essentially Nietzschean point of view. And my suggestion is that that overstates the case. That follows only if you grant the atheist assumption that our knowledge is the highest knowledge there is. Now, I mention this unwarranted slide from "we are not God, so our truths are not absolute" to "there is no God, so there is no absolute truth" in order to highlight what seems to me an equal but opposite non sequitur. Those who perceive postmodernism to be a threat to religion and morality often insist that there is absolute truth. Perhaps you've seen them get red in the face and pound the pulpit, "there is absolute truth." If they are theists, they have good grounds for making this claim. But listen closely and grab your wallet. For almost immediately, you will hear the further claim that they are the repositories of that absolute truth. By some magic, God's absoluteness has rubbed off on them. They have become the son of the Nicene Creed, epistemically of one substance with the Father. They assume that they cannot bear witness to an absolute being or an absolute event. if they themselves and their witness is relative. The logic of that seems to me on a par with thinking that we can't talk about violets unless we're purple. Now, the question that arises at this point, and that I've been deliberately postponing, is, but what about Revelation? But what about Revelation? And what I want to say about that is to invoke the Platonic image of the cave, where human life and all of its contingency takes place, and the sunlight in which truth with a capital T is accessible, and suggest that the cave is human history and the sunlight is heaven and the ultimate kingdom of God, and that Revelation has as its purpose guiding us to that sunlight, but that it takes place in the cave and under the conditions of the cave. The best way I know to express this is to appeal to my old teacher, Kenneth Conser. I had him as an undergraduate at Wheaton before he went on and became for a short time editor of Christianity Today, and then went off to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and was primarily the one who took that from being a mom-and-pop operation and made it a Fortune 500 seminary, a very large operation. I don't know any more non-compromising defender of biblical inerrancy than Kenneth Conser. And he used to tell us that the Bible is the divinely revealed misinformation about God. And you got to hear both halves of that. It's divinely revealed, and so you pay attention to it like you pay attention to nothing else. But it's the divinely revealed misinformation about God, because the revelation takes place in the cave. It doesn't magically transport us into the heavenly realms where we're no longer subject to the human condition and can, as it were, peek over God's shoulder or see the world through God's eyes. I don't know that he was thinking of Calvin when he made that point, but I suspect he was, because I know he was a great lover and student of Calvin. And Calvin was the one who said that when God speaks to us, he lisps. That God talks baby talk to us. When God tells us what he wants us to know, he does so in our language, not in the language of heaven. And I like to think of it this way. This is my parable on the text, the Bible is the divinely revealed misinformation about God. I have a 3-year-old son. I find him sucking on a quarter. I say to him, son, don't suck on quarters. He's 3 years old, so he says, why, Daddy? I'm not as dumb as I look, so I don't start talking about viruses and bacteria and immune systems and so forth. What I say to him is, look, there are little bugs on those coins. They're so small you can't see them, but they're really there. And if they get inside you, they'll make you very sick. Remember how awful you felt the last time you were sick? So don't suck on those quarters. I'm playing the role of God here, and the story I tell my son is the divinely revealed misinformation about quarters. From a level of knowledge to which he does not have access because of his limitations, I translate into the world of his comprehension the truth with a capital T, which now he has in the form of truth with a small t. Literally speaking, what he believes about those coins is false, with a capital F. But at the same time, it's true with a small t. It's what a 3-year-old ought to believe about coins. He ought to trust his father when his father tells him that. He ought to believe that. And most importantly, he ought to act on that belief. And he ought to keep acting on it even when he gets to be 5 years old and begins to understand, or maybe 8 years old, that story his father told him isn't the whole story. It isn't exactly like that. That's the best his father could do in terms of what he begins to have a Kantian awareness that his apprehension of the world isn't the normative apprehension of the world, that there is a superior knowledge of the world to which he doesn't yet have access. But in a relationship of trust in his father, he's still going to believe that he shouldn't suck on coins because there are little bugs on it that make him sick. And when he sees his three-year-old friend sucking on quarters, you know what he's going to say? Don't suck on those quarters. There are little bugs on them and they'll make you sick. My daddy told me that. And you better believe it. In a recent issue of Books and Culture, there's an essay entitled C.S. Lewis Among the Postmodernists. It makes very interesting reading, exploring what we might call the perspectivist, or perspectivalist, if you prefer, dimension of Lewis's thought. Like Derrida, we read, Lewis emphasizes that all analysis is situated, that there is no position of utter objectivity from which we may think about thinking itself. Perhaps Lewis's continuing freshness, the essay concludes, is rooted in his characteristic fusion of metaphysical affirmation and epistemological humility. This closing line suggests a sequel, Paul among the postmodernists. Isn't he the one that said that we suppress the truth in our wickedness? Isn't he the one that said, although everyone is a liar, let God be proved true? Only God has truth with a capital T. Although everyone is a liar, let God be proved true. Isn't he the one that said we have the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ in clay jars? Isn't he the one that said that in this life we see in a mirror dimly, or through a glass darkly if you prefer, and know only in part? He views human understanding, it seems to me, even apostolic understanding, as anything but absolute, in the sense of being equivalent to the divine understanding. And if there are many different glasses in which we see darkly, then there may even be an incipient perspectivism in Paul. This in spite of his unshakable confidence in divine revelation. Nor does his possibly perspectival epistemic finitism, that's a big mouthful, I'll repeat it, nor does his possible epistemic perspectival finitism make him bashful when it comes to charismatic mission. I often hear it asked in discussions of postmodernism, how can we preach the gospel if we are not possessors and dispensers of absolute truth? And my answer is quite simply, think Paul. That's it.